She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, normally a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Tie and badly painted licensed comics. I'm Charlie Etheridge-Nunn, a writer and a fan of Tom Scioli's Transformers vs. G.I. Joe Maxi series and the one-shot which adapted the fictional animated movie adaptation of said Maxi series.
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comic, but probably like the first like 2.5 volumes before it really gets all old man yells at cloud from volume 3 onwards. Although him having Harry Potter as the Antichrist is kind of fun.
That is a move that has only got funnier with time. Yeah, I'd say as works of fan fiction go, it's one of the classier ones.
Actually, no, wait, I've got one. I am a fan of the old 1960s comic TV-21, which had the comic strips of all the various Gerry Anderson shows and occasionally would have the strips cross over. So, like, the Hood would get up to shenanigans in Stingray, or there were just Mysteron agents everywhere in Captain Scarlet.
Huh, I had no idea there was such a thing.
Yeah, it was a pretty good quality comic. It had the reason I kind of originally know about it, apart from like the 90s reprints of the strips, was that there was also a one-page Dalek comic strip, which ran for like a couple of years, which was basically like the Daleks getting into like Dalek-y hijinks across the galaxy. Which was very fun. Those pepper-potted rapscallions.
Yeah, So, normally, we review and rank on our big list episodes of Star Trek. And this time, we're going to be having a look at a comic combining Star Trek and one of our favourite things. It's Star Trek The Next Generation / Doctor Who Assimilation Squared.
Charlie,
yes.
Just two things. One,
go on.
I am doing this under pressure.
Yes.
Okay. So we're recording the episode. Can you please release my cat?
I mean, maybe. It depends on how this goes. Because what if I release the cat and you just hang up on the call?
Shit, you've got a point. Okay. Yeah. Then, number two. Now that you've read the comic, I want an apology.
Oh, this is for tech war.
Now you see, here's the thing about tech war. At least it wasn't painted.
I mean, yeah, I resisted buying the comic of tech war when I saw that in Dave's comic.
You know what you can say about tech war? Mm. It wasn't boring. I mean, it was.
There were some very boring stretches.
Yeah, but not as boring as this gets for like from around about issue 1 to around about issue 6.
Yeah, yeah. We will get into at some point Star Trek X-Men, but that does require me to read a book, and as I'm sure we've covered on this show, I can't read, so it's going to be a little while longer before we do that. But before we talk about Assimilation Squared, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying lately?
Well, I just went back to play a video game I've not played in a while, which is Alien Isolation.
Ooh.
I admit, like, even though I've only seen one episode of Alien Earth so far because my life is a dysfunctional mess, everyone talking about it on the Breakfast in the Ruins Discord really made me want to play Alien Isolation again, because I've never actually finished the game, because what happens is, it's kind of like how I play Elden Ring. I play Ring for like a weekend every 6 months and then kind of realize why I don't play Elden Ring on the reg. Meanwhile, with Alien Isolation, I pick it up for about 3 to 4 days a year, make 5 minutes of progress, get stuck because the AI is too good at its job, get frustrated, quit. Last time, it turns out, last time I booted the game up was 2022.
Oh.
So I have decided to, you know, I did what every computer, what every video gamer who has a wife slash partner slash spouse worth their salt does, which is ask their partner, hey, do you think you're going to be playing this game in your account? No. Great. I'm restarting. And so I'm currently restarting the game on my wife's PlayStation account. I mean, the game is really good. It's just really difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had the same sort of thing with Hollow Knight. My partner's got back into playing Hollow Knight. And yeah, that's one I gave up on after a little while. As it was enjoyable, but at the moment I'm experiencing it through her horrors with it, rather than my own.
And so, Charlie, what non-Star Trek, non-Doctor Who thing have you been enjoying this week?
Well, yesterday I finished the fourth of the Southern Reach trilogy, Jeff Vandermeer's Absolution, which was good fun. It's one of those experiences where I finished it and went, I think I prefer the first three. But then that didn't stop me keeping thinking about it and the way in which the story weaves in and out of the first three books. I really enjoyed Authority and Acceptance as continuations of Annihilation, even though sometimes it can feel a little jarring at first, changing up the perspectives and the way in which they're presented. And Absolution begins kind of before Area X happens and shows that things are kind of fucked up already and puts you in the mind of someone that's central who will become the Southern Reach, or at least will control the Southern Reach. What they're doing in the Forgotten Coast, which will become Area X. And you've got this old spy, Old Jim, as his cover identity is, although you never actually learn his real name.
I'm sorry, Old Jim is the most northern seaside village drunk name you could come up with.
Oh yeah, and that kind of fits for cover.
Like everyone has a story about Old Jim. Is that, yeah? Once I found Old Jim trying to make love to a tin of soup.
Exactly, fucking hell, Old Jim. But yeah, that kind of, so you see an initial mission early on, which I had to stop for a moment and go, hang on, I think something's going on here that Old Jim doesn't know, but we do. And then we fast forward a bit to still before Annihilation, or at least before the events where Area X happens. And watching everything going towards it, there are a couple of moments which seem off in the continuity of what's happened before, but in ways that add to it, you know, ways which feel interesting and help recontextualize some of it all. So Okay. It was a fascinating experience, and I'm curious to see what his next thing set in the Southern Reach universe is, because I think it's supposed to be some mixed media kind of like bunch of evidence and letters and things.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
You may have inspired me to kind of try and wrap up the audiobooks I'm on and just kind of download and actually get through this entire inaccurately named trilogy of books.
Yes. Well, right. Yeah. And now from something that I've enjoyed.
Okay, good episode. At least it was short. If you want to reach out to us, supporter,
no,
yes,
no.
Live long. Nice, have a jelly baby.
We do
closing
need
music. You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Ty podcast.
You realize I'm the one editing this. I will control for vertical and the horizontal, neither of which actually matter in the audio medium, I realise.
Well, you can control the vertical of which ear the sound comes out of. if you actually fiddled with the sound settings.
God, in the early days of me listening to podcasts, I remember somewhere they would have two people talking, as is often the rule, but one on the left ear, one in the right ear. And that was really jarring at times, especially when my old earphones would break, so only one ear would be usable. And then I just wouldn't be able to hear a whole conversation. It would just be half of it. But no, we are here to discuss Star Trek The Next Generation, Doctor Who Assimilation Squared by IDW Publishing. And, oh man, there's a lot of credits here. So, just to give the quick rundown, this was released between the 30th of May 2012 and the 19th of December 2012. It was written by the Tipton Bros, Scott and Dave Tipton, and the first four issues co-written by Tony Lee. It was painted by J.K. Woodward on issues 1 through 3 and 5 through 8, and the Sharp Bros on issue 3. In addition, it was also penciled by Gordon Purcell on issues 4 to 8, coloured by J.K. Woodward on 4 through 5, and Fabio Mantovani on issue 6, lettered by Robbie Robbins on 1 through 3, Sean Lee 1 through 6, Tom B. Long on 7 to 8, edited by Denton J. Tipton, unrelated to the previously mentioned Tiptons, and Jason Smith, but Jason spelt with a C, from issues 6 to 8. It is an untroubled production that has that many credits on so few different roles.
Okay, so is Tom B. Long the most porn star starring name we've ever had on this podcast?
It's great. I'm pretty sure it's not a pseudonym. Yeah, I actually had a look. Yeah, so he has Tomb Graphics, or that's T-O-M-B graphics. Yeah, he's done a ton of Transformers comics and the IDW versions of Star Wars and Marvel characters for the licensed out all ages things. I started having a bit of a dig into who these people were in case any of them were specifically good or bad in other things, whether any of them we had to give a little asterisk about any problematic matter or anything. And none of them seemed to be bad.
I admit I have a little asterisk next to Tony Lee's name because he did write the Doctor Who comic, the regular Doctor Who comics for IDW for a while.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he likes to indulge in a lot of what I find needless fan wank, where it's like, okay, you can't go without like a page, without like a past reference to classic Who. And if one of your plot points is whether or not Turlough from the Fifth Doctor era actually kept a diary, or it's just an alien manipulating our comic only companion, resulting in the line from the David Tennant era Doctor, "Turlough never had a diary." I am sorry, Tony, can you put the laptop down, mate? You're bleeding from the eyeballs again. It is just, we Who fans do love our fan wankery past referencing, and sometimes it can get a bit much.
Yes, yeah, Tony was one of the more prolific writers one of the more prolific creators that I could see, having cut his teeth on reviewing ZX Spectrum games. He writes a ton of crime novels under the name of Jack Garland, and also wrote one issue of X-Men Unlimited, Volume 2, the most forgettable volume. I can't remember what his issue was about, but yeah. And Stalag 666 for 2000 AD, which I've not got round to reading yet. And an episode of Doctors. So yeah, he's done it all. The Tipton brothers apparently have written Star Trek comics from 2007 to 2020. I think this is the only Star Trek comic from that era that I've read. and Scott Tipton is also a comic historian. So, yeah, I don't know if this means that we're getting something indicative of what they usually do, because this is, you know, what, 5 years into their 13-year run? But it's not entirely indicative of what I would want to see in these. Like, I've read some of the Marvel Star Treks. In fact, when I first had a standing order at Dave's Comics, it was New Warriors, X-Men, and there was, what was it, Star Trek, Starfleet Academy, and Star Trek Early Voyages. As I was curious about the idea of Star Treks that weren't the main
TV show. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because there was a DS9 one.
Yeah. In terms of Star Trek comics, I've read some of the DC, I've read some of the DC stuff. I don't think I ever read any of the Marvel stuff when it was coming out. And some of the Malibu had the DS9 license. Mm. And Malibu was one of those companies which did seem to get on board with doing trades pretty early, and you could get those really cheaply put together Malibu DS9 trades in most charity shops, in most Oxfams. Yeah.
We had so many of them in the comic shop. We had boxes of them in storage. I think I read maybe just the first issue of the Malibu, none of the DC, aside from the Chris Claremont issues, of course. A few of the Wildstorm ones in my casually dipping in and out of Star Trek, even in comic form. When I was first uploading all my comics records to the CLZ comic app, which is, of course, for work for an obsessive maniac, I realized how few, even of the miniseries, I actually completed with them. So things like some of the Voyager one-shots were better for me for that.
Okay.
But yeah, and IDW wise, I think I read their prequel to the Star Trek 09.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I read a few of the Star Trek the comic which was the tie-in to Star Trek 09. But like a lot of the early issues were basically, we're just going to redo this story, but from the 09 cast kind of style, which okay. I think is fine for like once or twice, but you know, it would kind of get a bit samey. I've been keeping up with the recent, with the Star Trek and Star Trek Defiant. And I've been kind of keeping on. The Lower Decks has been fun. I know I've spoken about Red Shirts.
Oh,
I am looking forward to the new ongoing Star Trek The Last Starship, which comes out this week of recording, which has Captain Kirk resurrected somehow during the era of the Burn.
Right.
So I'm interested to see that would go. It's the same writing team as the Star Trek ongoing, and I really hope there's more kind of like Star Trek adventuring and not long going, because as enjoyable as the Star Trek ongoing was, it really got bogged down in all the kind of ongoing kind of god stuff, and I'm kind of like, I kind of just want to see these characters go on an adventure.
Yeah, I mean, we covered Godshock, and I've yet to pick up volume 2 of that or volume 1 of Defiant. I enjoyed what I read, but yeah, it's something where both in ongoing comics and in Star Trek, sometimes it is nice just to have it done in one kind of thing. And it is often fairly fleeting, really, and not something that they have so often. But yeah, like this series was one I actually picked up when it came out, apart from the final issue, which I bought a couple of months ago. I think because, again, my attention span with these things, like I hadn't added it to my standing order because I was just idly going, I like Doctor Who. I'm enjoying Matt Smith. I like Star Trek. why not get this? And then I forgot it existed in time to pick up for final issue.
See, I was picking this up monthly, and somehow it made the trip over to me in America. And I realized as I was looking at the dates when the comics were being published in the credits, I was like, oh, right. Midway through the comics, I literally emigrated countries. And then that's why I still have them, is because, like Netflix, you start the show, you kind of want to see how it ends.
God, yeah. I mean, it's nowhere near as large a distance, but I know there are some TV shows that I'd been watching via means of getting them off the back of a truck in my old flat, and things that I was reading that I halted when I moved over to here after everything that had gone on family-wise. And some of it, like Saga, I was up to volume 4, but the box of everything by my bedside cupboard was the last one to get packed. Was maybe one of the first ones to get packed, because it was at the bottom of everything else. So it took over a year until I found them, and momentum had kind of been lost.
Yeah, which is kind of how you can describe Saga right now, sadly. Like, it's a good comic, but like that very long gap they took between from issue 55 to like when they started up a few years ago, I feel like the momentum has really suffered for it, because like I remember like Saga was just a continuously like hit book.
Yeah. So we'll get into what the story is of this, but you and I have both bought a bunch of licensed comics over the years. I think you're someone that still is getting a bunch. I've fallen away a bit over time. I think for me, the big thing that I was getting regularly were Buffy comics, both in Dark Horse and then Boom as well. And I think it hit a point where I was enjoying them, but there were so many different series and miniseries coming out that I kind of got a bit fatigued. And the Dark Horse stuff tended to do that dancing between the raindrops of episodes and trying to retell the film in a way that was more towards what Whedon's vision of that would have been before Fran and Kaz Kazui futzed. And then the Boom Studios version was kind of, we're minimizing Joss Whedon's name here, and we're rebooting it. Consider it like the Ultimate Universe version, so things can be a bit different. You know, Xander seems a bit like a little incel-y, and then ends up a vampire, and Willow is gay from the start. And yeah, like people got to be a bit more fluid with what the license thing was, and actually drew them in ways which fit the artist's art style, but you could kind of tell were these characters.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't slavishly devoted like Salvador LaRocca's artwork on the Star Wars comics, where you can see at some angles, it's like, oh yes, here's a good press photo or a good screenshot someone's taken. This angle, uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Because they don't have this angle of Mark Hamill at that age, and it looks weird.
We get a lot of that in this comic.
Yes.
I mean, in terms of licensed stuff, I mean, honestly, one of my earliest regular comics as a kid, which wasn't Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends, was the Marvel UK Transformers comic, which was good shit back in the day, and, you know, for the most part, good shit still now. Admittedly, like, this last year, I've kind of been dropping away from comics just purely because of financial reasons. because like as much as I enjoyed the absolute verse and a lot of the various like Marvel stuff, I don't know, the fact that it just kind of seems to be spinning the wheels so much. And you know, in terms of original comics, I tend to go with like whatever Ed Brubaker or Kieran Gillen are putting out. But I've kind of been keeping up with some of the licensed stuff, because the recent IDW kind of rebooting of Godzilla has been pretty fun. There's kind of three titles all set in the same kind of universe. The main Godzilla book, it's been okay. Godzilla Escape the Dead Zone is much more kind of, I would say, F. Jeff Vandermeer wrote a Godzilla.
Right.
And the third title, Starship Godzilla, hasn't started yet, but it's a space opera comic about a bunch of people who are going around the galaxy in Mecha Godzilla, which has been transformed into a spaceship. And I'm like, fuck, you know what? That sounds high concept enough to be right up my alley.
Nice. Yeah, I actually...
I was a regular buyer of the X-Files magazine back in the day, which would reprint issues of the Topps X-Files comic, which had some art from Gordon Purcell. But his art was a bit too like very mainstream comic, and a lot of the first 20 issues or so were all drawn by Charlie Ardland, who would then go off on to do The Walking Dead. And I feel like his art was a bit more unsettling to kind of work with the X-Files. Unfortunately, his facial expressions still remain that kind of mouth wide open in existential shock.
Yeah, I remember skimming through the X-Files comics that Topps did, and while I wasn't as much a fan of those, I quite liked the painted adaptations.
Yeah.
The ones that John Van Fleet did, which had a very kind of inky, nice, like almost Jean-Paul Leon style to them. Lots of odd shadows. And while the faces weren't necessarily perfect, there was enough abstract work going on, enough kind of uniqueness of the style, but it didn't matter. It was like, oh yeah, let's see what he does with the ice episode and stuff like that.
I was also a big fan of like the Dark Horse and the Marvel Star Wars comics. Again, I've dropped off the Marvel Star Wars stuff because, again, it is just kind of, there's just too many series at the same time. And honestly, as a lot of like having the stuff, you know, be between the movies feels a bit more limiting than it did with like the Marvel stuff, which I feel because it was just the three films, or at the time two, then one, then two, then three, could be a lot more fun and have more done in one. So in the old Marvel stuff, because Luke couldn't meet Darth Vader, Darth Vader became a lot more Machiavellian, a bit more Doctor Doom, and kind of manipulating events from afar. But also, they were clearly writing it with, Darth Vader is not Luke Skywalker's father, so you could do a bit more. And honestly, I think that's my big problem with a lot of the main kind of mainstream, like the Star Wars and Star Trek tie-in comics, is that they get artists who are superhero artists first and not good. Like, so the art gets very superhero-y. And then I think of something like Star Wars Dark Empire, which was one of the first kind of Star Wars tie-in comics, which had art from Cam Kennedy, who did the VCs and Rogue Trooper for 2000 AD. And even though the faces aren't perfect representations, he really captures that kind of messy, used future feel that the Star Wars films had. So while the art isn't perfect, it really captures that aesthetic that makes Star Wars work.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I think both of us are on that same kind of page of, it's like, give us some interesting art and tell us that these are these characters. You know, humans have imaginations, and we can go, yeah, as long as it looks vaguely like them and you do an interesting style. And while in theory a painted look could work quite well, as we see in Assimilation Squared, trying to look too much like the press photos of actors and painting it doesn't quite land all the time.
I think the trouble is, especially with Matt Smith, he just has a very oddly shaped face.
It is an odd face.
Which doesn't always translate well to comic art. You know,
I mean, again, like, play with that weird shaped face, you know, do something interesting with it in the artwork. Don't hide from it, and don't try to make it look neat or fit within regular conventions, because it is an odd face.
All right, so Charlie, would you like to do the honors?
Yeah, I made notes for this damn thing. So, right.
Hang on. Let me just get this started properly.
Yes. Wow. I feel like I should have got the overly long scarf that we have over a banister that someone left years ago, and I like it, but I can't make scarves work. But for this, it could have been a good baker's scarf. Right, so 8 issues. I'm going to try and rattle through this. So, issue 1, Delta 4 gets attacked by Borg. Oh wait, no, there's something new as well. Cut to ancient Egypt, and the Matt Smith Doctor and the Pons are fleeing on a chariot. They're sneaking around a pharaoh's palace. The vizier's secretly an alien, and they get him sucked into a crystal. That's into a crystal. Then they go to San Francisco, 1941. They walk into a bar. Oh my god, it's some of the cast of TNG. Issue 2. On the Enterprise, Geordi's running diagnostics on Data, and they're heading over to Naya 7 to check out some mines, do a bit of PR exercise, a meet and greet, shake hands with some fish people who Worf says sound delicious. No, Worf, no.
We've had the meeting, Worf. We've had the meeting twice this year.
Exactly. A local says hi and then just fucks off. But a Starfleet captain, who I can't read my own writing of his actual name, but it won't matter, gives him the tour of the mines. A window cracks and floods. Oh my god. Yeah, luckily it gets sorted out. And while it's being fixed, Riker decides to have a crack at being Dixon Hill this time. The TARDIS appears. Yeah, that San Francisco in the past. It was the holodeck. I don't know how the Doctor didn't realise that it was all holograms. Meanwhile, the TNG folks assume that the Doctor and the Pons are holograms. And the Doctor's kind of impressed with Data. And when the program ends, yeah, of course they're still there. And the Doctor's starting to remember things from this universe, even though he doesn't remember being here before. Things like Klingons. He meets Picard, and they're called to Delta 4 because of the aforementioned attack and things. Issue 3, some kind of cyberborg says that there's no means of stopping them in doing all their shenanigans. And yeah, the Enterprise flees, hides in a nebula, and Data finds some records from the original Enterprise. Flashback to a different art style. Is it better? Only moderately. Kirk's haircut changes between two panels. Artists, what on earth? Anyway, yeah, it's all drawn this time, and on this planet where there's an old relay facility. It's all a bit suspicious. And, hey, the Fourth Doctor's there. Reference to Jelly Babies. You know the drill. Yeah, all the staff seem to be zombied out. Why? Well, because of Cybermen. There's a bit of a fight going on. Kirk does the proper double hand punch.
I'm just going to say the best panel in this comic is Kirk flying kicking a Cyberman.
Hell yeah. Yeah, they should have kept that energy. But yeah, the Doctor ends up scraping off some gold from one of the communicators, throws it like some pocket sand at Cybermen, and they stop. Everyone parts ways, and the old relay, it goes from blue to red. And Agamas has taught us that that means bad things. Oh dear. In the present, the Doctor says, yeah, that is him. He just looked a bit differently then, but he doesn't remember it. And sod it, why not get Guinan involved? She knows cosmic stuff. Issue 4. Guinan thinks the Doctor's younger than expected. Also, she knows what a TARDIS is. It's time for a meeting, just in case this all got too exciting. Everyone thought the Cyberman-Borg Alliance would head off to Earth, but weirdly enough, they've about-faced, like mid-assimilation. And they go to that midpoint, and yeah, they send Worf, Data, Riker, the Doctor, and the Pons. There's an immediate explosion of floaty-looking robot crystal things. Also, some kind of sparking Borg corpse, you know, like those wind-up little dinosaurs that used to spark out. They look kind of like that. There are some Cybermen corpses, but that'd mean they're fighting each other now. Oh my god, the Cybermen declared war on the Borg. They blew up some of their ships and are heading to the Borg homeworld to assimilate them now. The Borg call, and they kind of want a bit of a truce with Locutus. Picard, of course, says no. Issue 5. Picard's all grumpy. He's not going to speak to no Borg. Guinan appears and has a flashback to Best of Both Worlds to explain it all to the Doctor. And yeah, that's most of this. After she's sent away, Amy comes along to Picard's office, summons JL to the TARDIS, and is shown all sorts of futures. Quote, Kronos, oh my god, the Cybermen have cybered the Klingons. Oh my god, they've cybered the Vulcans and some of the Star Trek, some of the Doctor Who planets that I can't remember the names of. And further until Earth is cybered as well. They're cybering everything. Oh, those filthy bastards. Fine, he'll do it. Issue 6. Yeah, so they beam to a planet where the Borg tried Borging the Cybermen and failed, and it all went awry, where their big falling out happened. And yeah, they recover one Borg. I've skipped back there. Yeah, they head to a planet to have a peace talk with the Borg. They strip the assimilation tools from one of them who, oh my god, Riker recognizes him. It's Bertrand. I don't know who Bertrand is. It turns out this is his first appearance anyway. So he's someone Riker knows.
I think Bertrand is the captain of one of the Federation ships that gets attacked at Delta 4.
Oh, okay. Fine. But, yeah, that.
You know, that would have required us, you know, like kind of writing that back in earlier.
But yeah, so Borgtrand is taken along to the Enterprise and everyone's still a bit suspicious of him. The Cybermen apparently took over the Borg once they saw the Doctor arrive. So their peace talks were going well until they had a freak out when, oh fuck, it's him! And yeah, they're now off to the Borg Collective to try and control all of them. The Enterprise is going to need a lot of gold. They go to back to Naya because there's a lot of gold there, and they need to have a talk to the fish people about that. The Doctor and the Pons go back into a Borg cube at Wolf 359, and oh no, has Locuta spotted them? Issue 7, no, he's a Borg, and they've not done anything to activate his security yet. They have a poke around, copy their executive routines to try and help the Borg in their in the Enterprise's present. I realise referring to anything as anyone's present when the Doctor's around is foolish. But yes, they leave, and they can't do anything about Wall 359. I assume it's a fixed point. But yeah, it does feel a bit like, oh, thousands of people died. Oh, well. Yeah, they deliver the routines to the Borg and help the Collective recover with that. Then, yeah, they've got to get to the Cybermen fast. They're going TARDIS style. The Doctor, the Pons, Riker, Data, Worf, Borgtrund, and some extras as well, because, you know, some people need to die to show stakes. They arrive at the Cyber Armada. Rory's ambushed and saved by Worf, who, like, the two of them get pretty friendly with all this. They're like, hey, much respect, even though you're shit at fighting, boy. But yeah, Worf also lends the Pons phasers, and they're a bit like, well, the Doctor's somewhere else at the moment and would frown on us having guns, but go on then. Yeah, and as all this is going on, there's just so many Borg Cybermen everywhere. And finale, issue 8. Yeah, Worf and the Pons are doing a big assault. The Doctor, JL, and Data looking for the cyber controller while all these distractions are going on. The Cybermen suddenly wake up. They kind of like Data, and the rest of them they want sent processing. When they look at Data, it's like, oh no, he's already done. He's perfect. Love you, boy. The Enterprise catches up, so apparently it wasn't too far away. But yeah, they have a gold-infused particle beam, the blingest particle beam ever. They blow up a bunch of Cybermen. Everything's ruined, but the Cyber Commander isn't affected by gold. He tears himself out of all the machinery and goes into like, ah, oh, fuck it, we've done all this brain stuff, all of these things. I'm just going to hit people now. Kind of like the finale of Bioshock, where you've gone through a really good game and it's felt like there needed to be a boss level at the end, which was frankly unnecessary. Yeah, luckily, with all of that, they still managed to deal with him, you know? Yeah, like Data and Borgtrund bundle him. The Borg Matrix gets reconnected. They blow up the Cybermen and the cast flee to the TARDIS. Borgtrund, of course, betrays them because Borg, they're gonna do this, you know? They can ally with them any amount of times, but they're still gonna, yeah, give it a whirl. Yeah, let's see, the TARDIS, I've got TARDIS enters him. Yes,
the TARDIS
enters him.
The TARDIS
enters Data non-sexually. I've got specifically written here, non-sexually. But yeah, the TARDIS energy gets in Data. And yeah, Worf grabs Borgtrund. Rory opens the doors. Best team up of the whole thing. Fling him out into time and space. Hopefully not to any civilization or anything bad. And yeah, Riker has a bit of a mourn of Borgtrund. The Doctor leaves and the Borg are like, hey, this time travel thing is pretty rad. Maybe we should do a time travel. So yeah, that's Assimilation Squared.
Okay.
It sounds almost like a story when you recap it in like 12 minutes.
Okay. Where do we start?
So little of it stuck with me. That's why I needed to write it down.
I don't know. I don't know where to start. So I'm gonna start with two confessions along similar lines.
Okay.
Twice in my life, I have tried to write a Star Trek Doctor Who crossover fanfic.
I am unsurprised.
The first attempt would have been a Third Doctor TNG crossover, where the Third Doctor is somehow finds himself in the Star Trek future on a pre-warp society and is trying to help them from a catastrophe, thus breaking the Prime Directive. So the Enterprise is going to come down on him like a ton of fucking bricks. And it would have been like the Doctor being in kind of like a conflict between the Enterprise crew, because they're both coming at it from different but altruistic moral outcomes. And also, yep, the Doctor would have used Venusian Akito on Worf.
Of course. There we go.
Second attempt was inspired by how dull this comic was.
Oh. It
opened with Q appearing in the TARDIS, looking at the Doctor, going, fucking love you, mate. You're part of an omnipotent race of gods, and you choose to bucket to the system. Q flashes himself into some Time Lord robes, and then Q flash noises the Doctor, Amy, and Rory into the Star Trek universe. Because, you know, you can do these things in less than, like, two issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It would have been interesting to see some more Star Trek based quandaries, and it's interesting hearing your ideas there and this, where all of them are the Doctor will arrive in the Star Trek universe, because I mean, with the Doctor Who stuff, there aren't many distinctive interesting places that are commonly used. You go to a place, you move on. You know, that nomadic existence tends to mean...
It's also the thing of, like, in Doctor Who, time travel is pretty much a plot device. Apart from when you get to the Moffat era, when time travel becomes a lot more important how the stories are told. But you have that thing of, you know, you can have something happen which, you know... I got the implication from the text that the reason that it was the Cybermen who got into this universe...
Yeah.
Because the Cybermen used in this story are the Cybermen from the modern show, which is from an alternate Earth, which then got sucked into a void between dimensions with the Daleks at the end of season 2, because that's when we lose Billy Piper and the 10th Doctor is ruined forever. Fucking honest, sorry. And so you have every so you get some of the Cybermen escaping that dimension, like in that one Christmas special where David Morrissey thought he was the Doctor with the giant fucking Cyber King. Trouble is, these Cybermen kind of, despite the fact they look like the Cybermen, pretty much act like the Cybermen we get in the classic show, who have empires and spaceships. And in the flashback, we get the camp 70s mincing Cybermen from Tom Baker's only Cyberman story. And if you ever thought that a Cyberman could be camp, my God, these are the most hands-on hips. They are literally all but mincing their way around a space station.
I can't wait to see that.
But you get a fantastic line. It's like, you'll be present for the biggest bang in history. Marches off, hands on hips. It's kind of amazing. It is fantastic. Also, in that same episode, you see Tom Baker and Liz Sladen trying hard not to laugh at the stupid lines they're delivering and ruin the fucking take. It's amazing.
Excellent. With this, I realized in issue recap what kind of things, like issue 1, barely anything really takes place, and issue 5 is just Picard is grumpy. There you go.
There is a lot of deconstructed storytelling in this comic where it doesn't need to be. And it shouldn't. Really shouldn't be. Like, you have 8 issues.
Mm.
You can have enough shit to have to fill 8 issues without it being everyone just stands about talking. And okay, it's Star Trek The Next Generation, the most stand about talking of all the Star Treks.
Oh, they love a meeting room scene.
But you know, you could do like the plot doesn't seem to really get going till issue 6. It's very kind of Picard is grumpy and wants to let the Cybermen wipe out the Borg because, you know, Picard's Borg trauma never goes away. No matter how many times he says, I've come to terms with my Borg trauma. And then you have issue 7, which is them traveling back to Worf 359 to get the MacGuffin they need for the final battle. And he's just like, you could do more. Like, you could have some actual conflict between the different storytellings of and kind of ideology of Doctor Who meets Star Trek.
I mean, the Worf 359 thing, I let out a bit of a disappointed sigh when that happened, because it feels far too often like, oh, you're back to that well again. And as fun as the Borg can be, they are very easily overused, especially post the Berman Braga kind of era, where you go, okay, post First Contact, all of these extra bits of media and extra things just constantly seem to have to go back to it.
I mean when you were talking about why couldn't they change anything with the thing of the fix with it being a fixed point, I think the Doctor does mention it being a fixed point. And of course, you have to have the Doctor being sad about being in a tragedy where millions die and he can't do anything. But also, there is the thing where one of the big... With Doctor Who, you can't... Time can be rewritten to an extent, but you can't change personal history. And that's the thing, because the Doctor, Amy and Rory have met Picard, they can't go back and change Picard's own personal history because they would be changing their own immediate timeline. Like in the one episode of the Christopher Eccleston Doctor Who, where Rose inadvertently stops her father from dying, thus changing her own timeline.
Yes, with the wibbly demon things.
The Reapers, yeah. That.
Yes.
And I get... I get the toy box frill of wanting it to be the Cybermen and the Borg. They're just too similar. They're just two similar types of baddies for it to be to be really that interesting.
Yeah, and you know, I get the intent that both betray each other. It's like both of them do that constantly. But yeah, I don't know, maybe if there was some kind of amalgam universe situation going, oh yeah, yeah, these are, you know, the Borger men, and they, both of them are like that, and we need to somehow separate them, because they're even more assimilating. They are assimilation squared. Yeah.
Okay. IDW couldn't get the rights to the Daleks because the Nation Estate is notoriously like they all sit in those rights and not give them out if you don't give them enough money. But it's like, you know, the Cybermen and they're just not, they're too similar. It would be like, say, I don't know, like in a, say, like a crossover between Batman versus Superman versus Spider-Man, like having, you know, the villains they have, I think it was the Kingpin and Doc Ock, or like, I think when they did a Spider-Man Batman one back in the 90s, where it was the Joker and Carnage. You can have villains who can kind of complement each other, but you kind of want there to be some kind of differentiation.
Well, I mean, what would be interesting is sticking with Cybermen, but have it as some kind of Star Trek challenge and using the, oh yes, we've dealt with the Borg so many times kind of playbook, only to realize, oh no, these are a whole different kind of horror.
Yeah.
And then if they're doing one of their many, well, we're just augmenting and helping the Romulans or someone, you know, like the Romulans love dodgy tech.
Yeah.
And the Klingons, despite all the honor talk, if there's a way to cheat their way into victory, they will still take it. So yeah, like, yes, we've got a way to combat, augment our Klingons.
Or just not have it be like the moment, like the brief moment of energy is that issue free kind of flashback to the Fourth Doctor and TOS, because shit is happening. Like,
yeah,
you know, hell, okay, fine. Captain Kirk is double fisting a Cyberman or doing a flying kick. Be like, God, there's some energy here. It's not just standing around talking. It's just there's some action.
Yes. Also, I know what you were saying about getting superhero artists drawing comic adaptations, but at the same time, the drawn style in issue 3 really saved it for me, with the Sharp brothers making some dynamism happen compared to J.K. Woodward's like slightly sludgy color palette.
I think the Sharp brothers kind of just capture the look of TOS, that very kind of bright colors, very pulp sci-fi, which the Doctor just kind of just strolls in. It feels like a set from like a 60s or 70s episode of either show. Whereas the painted artwork or the drawn artwork, which is then painted over, really robs everything of energy. And that's really what this series is lacking.
Yeah. I mean, it creates a kind of not just a static style, which sometimes you get that anyway in some comics where the art feels really still. As good as Alex Ross is, his work doesn't have much movement, much momentum to it. But with this, I feel an amount of it is questionable in some interesting ways. There are some shots of Matt Smith where it looks like he's missing parts of his face. And I know he's a fairly thin person, but it feels more like something has gone wrong than you're doing an exaggerated version of.
There is a lot of dull surprise expressions in this book. And there are some expressions where characters look like they've just shat themselves in the most unexpected and embarrassing way.
There are so many of those. I feel sorry for Celeste and Sean, who have had to suffer, both of us posting to a group chat several images. And oh my, when this episode comes out, we will be sharing images with the public about all of this as well.
Like,
and I hate to dunk on an artist that isn't a piece of shit, or, you know, like with people like Rob Liefeld, we all know the issues with him, but it's so much of it feels like the worst versions of adaptation comics. There are some shots where, even with the Sharp brothers' Kirk, like, he's more red-faced, and with the short, like, film-era hair on one page, and then you go to another page, and it's gained a parting. And it's like, oh, shit, how did that happen? Or, like, with Picard, there's a whole issue where he seems to have comedy giant eyebrows on. And I know he's, you know, the prominent eyebrows, one of the reasons why he's a perfect Professor X with old P-Stew. But, they look like caterpillars.
It reminded me of, there's like a little very subtle, like, sight gag in All-Star Superman, where Lex Luthor is just really vain and cares about his appearance that he paints his own eyebrows. And I think it's in issue 5 where it's the issue where it's Clark Kent and Lex Luthor in prison. And there's a point where Lex has to paint an eyebrow back on, and he's given it like a huge comedic arch, like his eyebrow is raised.
Yes, that's in fact weirdly reminiscent of is it Sanji from One Piece, who has one elaborate eyebrow and one normal eyebrow, which is very weird. I'm still not entirely sure of his reasoning for that, but yeah, like so many of the bits of artwork, like Amy Pond looks like either press shots of Karen Gillan, or just a woman with red hair that looks entirely different. There are some incredible shots.
At one point, she does look like Kelly Sue DeConnick.
Well, and Rory as well, who is possibly the biggest culprit of the looks like he's just shat himself kind of thing. I don't know if it's that all the press photos of him are of him expressing kind of mild surprise, like mild shock kind of. But again, so many of them, unfortunately, despite Arthur Darvill having a distinctive look, so much of this just makes him look like a guy.
There's one cover where I think it's the kind of they go down to the planet and find all the dead Borg. Like Amy and Rory are in the background, and Rory's face is so indistinct that he looks like he's just really sad. And he also looks like he's 12.
Yes. Yeah, there are, like, there are some fascinating issues with this comic, looks-wise. And I mean, like, J.K. Woodward has done a lot of painted comics. He's done X-Men Origins Beast, which I don't think I actually own. He's done a bunch of adaptations for like CSI comics and things like that. And Fallen Angel, which is, while it's not a media adaptation, it's the kind of thing where it had this similar, slightly sludgy painted kind of quality where you go like, would some more colors have killed you?
But I think it would work perfectly if, like, say, like a CSI, which is a prime procedural, whereas this, it's kind of meant to be, it's meant to be like an action adventure, and it never kind of feels it.
No, it's not incredibly bad. Like, it's poor quality. The story isn't much. It isn't like a crime against nature. It's not like a holy terror or any of those kind of things. It's not Doomsday Clock, where like Mary Marvel sees Dr. Manhattan's penis at one point, or any of these kind of things. But it's real bad.
It's just it's a waste of, like, it's a real waste of potential.
Yeah. I mean, that said, one of the notes that I put here is, it was interesting going, okay, but I'm sure they've mentioned Star Trek in Doctor Who. And having a look on the TARDIS Wikia, there is the brilliantly phrased, the canonical Star Trek franchise has never formally acknowledged the existence of Doctor Who, which feels like a kind of, like, unofficially,
yeah,
they are aware.
They are aware. I think there's a few, like, there's usually, I think there's like a reference or a shout out in a novel. Peter David has written Star Trek novels. You know there's a Doctor Who reference. There's a Blake 7 reference.
Oh,
in a DS9. Doctor Who has referenced Star Trek, though.
Yes.
With the fantastic line from The Empty Child where Rose demands that the Doctor give her some Spock.
Hmm. Well, see, that's the thing with Doctor Who fictional, like mentioning Star Trek as a fictional thing, rather than going, well, obviously they can't both exist in this fashion, I'm choosing to feel that this means they coexist in a kind of Grant Morrison multiversity style where fiction is used as a window into alternate realities. And as such, when they're watching Star Trek in Doctor Who, it is a portal into that reality.
Doctor Who has referenced directly Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy at several points. With a few, like, there's a few kind of references. In like David Tennant's first episode, he says he looks very Arthur Dent in his dressing gown. And in a Seventh Doctor New Adventure, the Seventh Doctor has met Sherlock Holmes and Watson, and they fought Cthulhu. At one point, Holmes and Watson get taken to an alien planet. Watson is surprisingly okay with it, and Sherlock Holmes is freaking the fuck out.
Okay,
because Watson says like, "Yeah, I've been to different countries. I've been to Afghanistan. I fought in a war." And Sherlock Holmes like, Sherlock Holmes like, "I am freaking out right now. This doesn't make a lick of sense."
Yeah, none of this looks like London from my era.
Although there's a fantastic part in that same book where the Seventh Doctor goes to a club where the Third Doctor is hanging out, like a gentleman's club. And the Third Doctor is doing the crossword, and the Seventh Doctor just kind of leans over and tells him all the answers just to piss himself off.
Great.
Which is more fun than this comic here.
Yes.
I did like the appearance of Guinan.
Guinan made a lot of sense.
Although I've always said that Whoopi Goldberg would be a fantastic actor to play the Doctor if you wanted to piss off like the racists and the sexists and the people who believe that the Doctor should only be played by someone from the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So, I feel we've probably run our course slightly with this. Rather than reading Star Trek The Next Generation / Doctor Who Assimilation Squared, what would you recommend
for people read? I just want to quickly, while doing research, we found out there was a planned sequel comic.
Yes!
With it being Doctor Who and Deep Space Nine, with the 11th Doctor and Clara, which would have had the Sontarans and the Dominion teaming up. And meanwhile, Section 31 is trying to nick the TARDIS. Which annoys me, because all that sounds a lot more fun. Because also, the Sontarans are a lot more fun than the Cybermen.
Well, and yeah, the Section 31 side of it sounds like it could have been delightful. You know, just like, oh god, are they going to put pressure on Bashir to go, you know, go nick a TARDIS? You're a doctor, it likes doctors.
And like, they would specifically have, it would be the era, you know, obviously it's the Dominion War era, so like, Worf would be there, so they can get over that whole tedious kind of crossover stuff, which I feel gets the first three issues kind of bogged down by Worf going, oh fuck, it's the Doctor. Okay, yep, I know this guy. Oh god.
Do you not have my friend Rory? He was a fine warrior.
Where is Rory? My favorite of all the humans. they make references to Rory having been the last Centurion Plastics, and you're like, come on, Rory occasionally gets his fight on, and it's like, come on, man, Rory, bat left some Borg, just grab Worf's bat left and start chopping through. Come on, give me something to work with. Although, last thing, did you notice how? When the Doctor shows Jean-Luc Picard the dark future where the Cybermen have converted everybody, the Cyber Klingons still have robot hair, have like the robot long hair.
I mean, it must be the optimal thing, given the way the Cybermen are, similar to them still having Batleths.
Okay, so what am okay? So on recommending, what am I recommending?
So, in place of Star Trek The Next Generation / Doctor Who Assimilation Squared, what tie-in thing would you recommend that the listeners check out?
Honestly, I mean, in terms of licensed Doctor Who tie-in comics, there's a lot to recommend. in varying degrees of continuity and depth. But I think if you ask me offhand, I would have to go with recommending Doctor Who The Iron Legion and Doctor Who Dragon's Claws, which the two reprint volumes which have the whole of the Doctor Who Weekly Tom Baker era. It's also written, it's all mostly written and drawn by 2000 AD alumni, so you have some, you have a lot of Dave Gibbons art. You've got stories by Pat Mills, John Wagner, and basically the comic gets taken over by Steve Moore, no relation to Alan. And so there is a lot of 2000 AD fun for 2000 AD for 7 to 8 year olds. So it has all that kind of the energy and the excitement, but with a minimal amount of the ultra violence.
Okay.
And also, the volume The Iron Legion contains Doctor Who and the Star Beast, which was turned into the first of the three David Tennant 60th anniversary specials.
Of course. Cool. Personally, I have little enough experience with Doctor Who and little enough memory of the Star Trek comics, so my recommendation for anything tie-in comic-wise is actually a tie-in to a board game. No, they've not done a Settlers of Catan adaptation. Instead, this is the board game Dead of Winter, which I was extremely surprised to see that Kyle Starks, who I'm a big fan of, was drafted to write a, I think, 4-issue miniseries, which has been collected as Good Good Dog, as the lead character for it is Sparky, a former stunt dog. And yeah, it's a tale of him and varied other characters from the Dead of Winter board game, which is a board game with some narrative elements in a zombie apocalypse. So you get to see a mall Santa being a real shit. And if you go, I think it's from Board Game Geek, you can get a version of it as a collection that comes with a bonus character who is a very much a Kyle Starks character. His name is Ruckus and his role is unemployed. If you don't start with him as a character, you can encounter him in the story deck by offering to have a joint with him, basically. But yeah, the main star here is Sparky the stunt dog, who the artist Gabo draws wonderfully. And you will have some moments of tension, but I should probably say, just in case people do want to read it and get stressed out, the dog does live. It's all right.
Okay. There was a film, I can't remember what it was called, which came out a couple of years ago, where the trailer ends, there's a dog, it's an action film, and the trailer ends with the dog lives. And I'm like, I'm like, thank you, I appreciate that. Okay, you've spoiled the tension of whether or not the dog dies or not, but I've seen John Wick and it's fine.
So, as this is a bonus episode, next time we're probably back to our usual Star Trek televisual shenanigans. But until then, you can find us on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social, on Ko-fi at Casual Trek on there if you want to throw us some money and suggest, you know, maybe there's another questionable Star Trek comic that you want us to cover. Give us money, we'll do it. And Miles, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Blue Sky every so often under my regular account of milesreadlibato.bsky.social, and you can find me at my blog of mareadlibato.wordpress.com.
Okay, and you can find me on skyshark.itch.io, both online and as my handle on Blue Sky. And at Fate Tales, where you can read me talking about comics fairly regularly, or on my Facebook account, which is Charlie Etheridge Nunn, where I talk literally every day about X-Men. And it's going to be Avengers versus X-Men time soon as a recording. So I'm going to get insufferable about an event that was very stupid, but I kind of liked. So yeah, and with that, go do a Starfleet.
And have a jelly baby, and don't eat any fish aliens, no matter how tasty they may look.
Yeah, Worf.
Instead, just stick one in your ear, and you'll be able to understand all spoken languages, including Welsh.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.